Close that back door, please.
Scarf, two scarves.
It's one, but this
one. Oh, that is beautiful.
It's silk. Really it looks, it well.
Yeah, it's lovely.
Okay, we're going to open the House Committee on Human Services and Housing. We'll open up an informational hearing on housing and community services. So, Margaret, thank you for coming. We have Margaret, Lisa Wendt, John Van Landingham, and Jim Tierney. So thank you all for coming.
Four of us, should we?
Yes, we can seat four people up there, don't we? We have several people who are suffering from allergies who have gone home. So we're sorry we're a small group today. Why don't you, Representative Gilliam will be here late.
Okay, all right.
And Gomberg should be here.
He had to testify, he said, on a bill.
Yeah, right. Thank you for coming. So start, however.
Okay. Chair Tomei and members of the committee, my name is Margaret Van Bleet. I'm the Director of Oregon Housing and Community Services Department. And pleased to be here today, really, to give you an update on where we stand with the transition planning effort, to respond to any questions you have, and just introduce you to a few members of an advisory body that we've assembled that will help me distill the many recommendations that are going to be coming down the pike. And I wanted you to have a chance to hear from a couple of them as well. So,
thank you.
So we do have a little bit of a slide show here that I will walk you through quickly, but not too quickly. A couple of things I wanted to sort of start with. One is this, to just really be clear that we haven't made any decisions. There's no predetermined outcome of where things would change, where different programs would go. That's all still very much being analyzed and discussed. So this is a process update. This isn't asking you to, you know, make decisions. That said, we'd be delighted to know if you have concerns or recommendations or things you want us to focus on. I'll go back to sort of the starting point of this conversation, which was really launched with the governor's budget back in December, really calling on us to take a hard look at the way we deliver our programs to see if we could both drive better outcomes for low-income Oregonians and also address a fiscal crisis that the agency will be facing in the next couple of years if we don't make changes. So there's really a couple of pieces to this. It's partly a fiscal crisis, but I think it's also much more than that, and I'll come back to that theme a couple of times today. The goals that the governor laid out include improved service delivery, stronger community partnerships, clearer governance, and better outcomes for Oregonians. The other thing I like to point out, so that people don't worry that just this housing agency is being picked on, that this is very much part of a larger effort to try and think differently about where state government is going, about what our job is at the end of the day, and to really get focused on long-term, what are we here to do for taxpayers, for citizens, for low-income Oregonians. And so I see this effort very much in that bigger picture context. So today what I want to do is just update you on the activities that have been going on since December and since I spoke with you earlier in the session. This is a quick look at the kind of communications, the engagement we've been involved in, talking with folks in this building, talking with our many stakeholders through a variety of means, definitely engaging our employees, trying to keep a web presence that's updated and current so people can check in as it works for them. And we've had a little bit of media coverage, not much, but really trying to make sure that we don't do this in a vacuum and that people can track it in real time. So this is a timeline that shows from April just past to February 14. And that time frame is really hinges on this call for me to come back and report to you and to the governor in February, the February short session, with a proposal for how we could do service delivery differently for these programs and services. So I'll take a couple of minutes here and walk you through the segments of this timeline. But broad brush, this is how the next several months play out. And there's really sort of four phases, if you will. We're in phase one, which we're calling preparation. And I'll spend a little bit more time on what's involved with that. Later in the summer, we're going to begin, with the help of some independent consultants, developing scenarios for how it could look differently. We'll spend the fall evaluating those scenarios and talking with you all, and then come back again in the February short session with some recommendations for what it could look like. Again, I think one of the pieces to underscore is that we very much intend to do this with a lot of transparency and engagement, not trying to imagine that my staff or I could go in a room and sort of figure this out without the good thinking and help of our expert community partners. The other thing to know is that when we started this back in December and January, we heard a lot from our community-based partners about what you would call guiding principles. What do they really want out of the system? What are they nervous about? What do they want to make sure that we guard against or aim towards? So those guiding principles have been, you know, very much part of our thinking and our discussion. They remain sort of front and center on our website, and we refer back to those, and I think we'll continue to do so as we go forward. This is just another quick look at the sort of formal communication efforts, dovetailing with more informal speaking engagements that I'm taking advantage of. But there's lots of audiences, and this is one way to depict that over time. So the phase one of the transition planning process, again, preparation, really starts with good program data collection. And this becomes important so because, as you've heard me say, we run something like 49 programs. We get funding sources, 64 different funding sources, lots of both federal and state statutes and rules and history and guidelines. And we want to sort of boil that down and make sure that we understand the facts as they really exist. Not the sort of urban myths, not the, well, we've always done it that way, but what are really the facts about how does the funds flow, what was the original legislative intent, what are key performance indicators, if any, are indicated, what should they be, what might they be going forward is a different question, but really just trying to understand how does the money flow today, and what are the facts behind that. The next thing that we'll start up here very quickly is best practices or alternative practices. We know other states perform similar functions but do it differently. So we want to understand those pieces and have those at the ready to sort of think about what's possible. We know that people in our industry have a lot of just good ideas, and we want to make sure we make room for that. Even if somebody's not doing it, what you may hear from some of these folks here with me today or others is, you know, I've always thought if we could just structure this program or this funding source in this way, it would make our lives so much easier. Well, we want to capture that, right? So this phase is just gathering a lot of information to inform everybody what's happening. But infused in all of that is this piece at the bottom, which is labeled, for lack of a better term, interagency prosperity lens. And that's this idea that it has to be about more than just efficiency, right? It can't just be about saving the dollar, although that matters. It has to be about getting something even more sort of powerful, if you will, on the ground. That it has to be about outcomes for low-income Oregonians. It has to ask some of the really big questions about how are we structured in state government and how can we align better with our colleagues in state government. And so that's going to be a piece that I think we'll come back to. It's a lot less tangible than just program data, but I think it's really critical that we infuse all of this with some of that that good thinking. I think those are the pieces I wanted to point out here. what's going on there through the spring and into the summer. When we have all those facts and ideas and notions about best practices, then I think we can move into this scenario development phase. And this is where we have to refine what you might call decision criteria, right? Put those sort of guiding principles, if you will, those big aspirational ideas about making life better for low-income people. How do you put them into some decision criteria that would help you decide between competing models for how it could look differently? So I think that's got to come up fairly quickly, that we take the good input we've already been getting from our community partners and about what we know could look different about service delivery and begin to shape some decision criteria. And I think if we do that in a very transparent way, that that's going to be very helpful and useful to the process before we start putting supposals, if you will, on the table. And then also in the summer, although this timing could move slightly, and I want to talk with the folks I've asked to join me on this advisory committee, we do need to bring together some folks to start thinking, help us think about, A, what should the decision criteria look like, and what do they want to know as we begin to bring them scenarios. And then as we move into the fall, we'll certainly be back in front of you all to provide as many updates and as much information as we can. But we really want to, begin to sort of imagine what's possible in this scenario development phase. Now, let me talk a little bit about this advisory committee. Because I think it's an important component of how I'm thinking about getting through the next several months. So this is the roster of names. You may recognize some or most of those. I've got three of them here with me today. You're going to get to hear from them. But I see this as a group that can frankly help me when there's lots and lots of input and voices and perspectives and ideas that they can sort of come together and ask me the hard questions and help me decide between competing scenarios. So it's a very sort of cross-sectional diverse group that comes from housing finance, comes from community services, comes from the energy sector. Some are folks who are deeply immersed in our world, and some had never heard of, a couple of them had literally not heard of Oregon Housing and Community Services Department, or never, much less thought much about what these programs are. So it's a group that I'm hoping can really come together and help me distill between competing scenarios and help me apply the filters of big picture, long-term thinking, alignment with other work in state government, and helping low-income people move towards prosperity. Their role is purely advisory, so if I don't like what they have to say, I'm not bound by it. So John's going to sign up, not decide. I think I want to surround myself with people that I know can help me think long term, and they may have some notions about that they'd be willing to share with you today as well. As we get into the fall, we'll start evaluating those scenarios. Again, in an effort to be really transparent, we'll make, as scenarios sort of come out of the consultant's work and the analysis, we'll make them available so that people can see what's happening in real time, and we'll offer them opportunities through a variety of forums to gather good feedback and reactions, if you will. But I think the advisory committee will also try and distill that and look at big picture view. And maybe one of the distinctions I would make here for you is that a lot of times People will come and advocate for a particular solution or a particular structure that's really best for their organization. And they know really, you know, Jim here is one who would know really well what model would work. Package these programs in this way. Maybe we could marry this one over here. It would make his life easier on the ground. But it might have unintended consequences. And so the notion here is marry that sort of on-the-ground, real-time organizational perspective with something that's longer term and bigger picture, and see if we can't balance those two. And I think those are the pieces I want to say about that. As we get into, I'm going back one. Sorry. I want to go back to this kind of prosperity lens, this idea that we are aiming towards a larger agenda within state government, but really, again, for low-income Oregonians. I actually think this is the most exciting. It's going to be the hardest, most intangible piece to get our heads around, but I think it's the most exciting. I genuinely believe that we have a very unique opportunity here to change our approach in ways that move the needle in the right direction on poverty. I have heard everyone on this committee and other people in this building speak about this in a number of ways. And the numbers of Oregonians experiencing poverty, including generational poverty, keep moving in the wrong direction. We have hundreds of tools in state government, programs, streams of money that seek to address the symptoms of poverty, but we tend to apply them in isolation too often. And we rarely seek the holistic view of changing the underlying causes of poverty. Our community partners mostly figure out how to get the job done in spite of the barriers we've put up in government. And if you think back to that chart I showed you that I called the spaghetti chart a couple of times, the interweaving of programs and money and governance structures and people on the ground have to go here and then there and then there. I think what's true is that those community partners have figured out how to do that well. This is an opportunity for us to make their jobs easier, in my judgment, as they do the real work on the ground of serving low-income folks. You will hear a little bit more about this from my colleagues. For me, this is about questioning what we do and how we do it. It's about putting our organizational structures second and asking the really hard questions first about what's our role in state government. And if we do this right, we can make much more meaningful progress in ensuring our public dollars and our programs actually move people towards economic independence. I've heard folks on this committee say this repeatedly. Housing is the cornerstone for all the other things we say we want to do better in Oregon. We want to help people get well-paying jobs. We want to help elderly and disabled people remain healthy and independent as long as possible. We want to ensure that our children are ready to learn, and we want to move people to prosperity and dignity to the greatest extent possible. None of those things are possible for our citizens if their housing is inadequate. So let's work to get this part of the safety net functioning as well as possible. I think about the decisions we make to invest in a particular apartment building, and we don't often talk with our colleagues at DHS and say, well, how could we marry these apartment units with one of your efforts around, for example, family reunification? Or how could we think about reserving this suite of apartments in this building for people who are working towards economic independence? Whatever it is, we don't make decisions in real time today that draft on what are the bigger picture things we're trying to achieve, and I think this is an opportunity to do that. This project really only touches the very beginning of that work, but I believe it's a critical first step. It will surface probably lots of other compelling questions that I can't possibly get answered in February, but I do think it's a long-term effort that's worth doing, and I'm really pleased to have the opportunity to do it, and frankly, the interest of folks on this committee and elsewhere in the building. So as I move to wrap up my piece of this, the phase that gets us to February 14 is just these kind of recommendations. I expect to be, again, back in the building as often as you'll have me, while I'm also talking to folks out in the communities about what this should look like. I have every intention of practicing lots of transparency throughout the process. I don't intend to, nor do I think I could do this alone. So I really want to have as many conversations as folks can tolerate and really bring forward some recommendations for a new delivery model that can move us forward. So that's a lot of process. What I'd like to do now is introduce my colleagues, or they can introduce themselves, but each of them I've worked with in different ways, but for a variety of, for many years, really, and I'm just delighted that they, on short notice, said yes to join me today, but also longer term, were willing to sit on this advisory committee with me. So,
thank you, Margaret. Any questions of Margaret? Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The Chinese big deal, so I may not be able to stay the entire, so I want to get this in. Madam Chair, this committee, and I know you personally have been very involved in foreclosure and helping distressed homeowners in last session and this session. Last session, we passed 1552 to begin the process, and the director was a key player in that. This session, we came in and tried to correct some things that we always don't quite get right in 558. But I'm disappointed to learn that the Ways and Means Committee has really shortchanged addressing this attention, this issue, which had so much front page news last year and had some very unfavorable things to say about me and my legislative performance. So I'm going to be probably talking to the press about how unhappy I am that the decision is being made in the Ways and Means process this session. We passed policy. We didn't get to look at 558 in this committee because it went to the Ways and Means process. I looked at the bill. I had some inputs to the bill. But it all comes down, committee members and people watching at home, to money. And the director and her staff and a lot of people in our communities spent last year and up to this time developing a system to help distressed homeowners. We go back a little ways and remember that we got, there was over $26 billion given to different states to address foreclosure, mediation, legal aid, and outreach. Oregon's share of that was $29.3 million. We really fought last session to start the program, but we really only funded for 1 year by the time everything got placed. So last session of the, remember.
Representative, I'm going to, did you have a question
yes,
here?
Yes, ma'am. I want to say that I think this has to be put on the record that we had $29 million that these people had money, they're involved in helping these foreclosure people. We had $29 million. $5 million was spent last year. That left $24 million. These people went in and asked the Ways and Means process for $8 million. They got $4
million. Who are you referring to these people?
The director and her people were asking, and housing allowance people were asking for more money for counseling, for mediation, for legal aid. And they were only funded at $4 million. That's still, my point is, where is the $20 million being spent that was supposed to be given to us to help distressed homeowners? So I think that this is very discouraging. It took us a while to create the system to help people, but you can't help people without the funds. And the banks and the Department of Justice gave us the money, and the money is not being used to help distressed homeowners. I'm not sure where it is. I'm going to see if I can find where the money is and the director has done a great job of what she has. I know in my community, we need more money. We have a counseling system. We still have a lot of people, houses upside down. I appreciate all the work you've done. You had a lot of criticism when you came in this office, As the director, I think you've done a great job in this program and others. And Madam Chair, again, I think because of your interest and this committee's interest in helping distressed homeowners, I'm disappointed in the Ways and Means process that more money was not given to this program to really help and to solve the problem and get help people that can be helped. Thank you, Madam Chair, for your indulgence.
Margaret, is that something you can respond to, or should we come back at a later time?
Chair Tomei, Representative Wisnant, what I can say is that the Ways and Means Subcommittee, which for my agency's Transportation Economic Development did pass our budget out just this afternoon earlier with the amount that the was in the governor's recommended budget. So just, I did want to clarify that the agency wasn't asking for more. We of course, stand behind what's in the governor's recommended budget. Certainly, our partners, I think, have been asking for more. One of the things I clarified for the committee earlier today, and then I'd be happy to come back, is there's lots of things going on with foreclosure. There is, on the one hand, the money that Representative Wisnant refers to that came to Oregon from the National Bank settlement, and some of that was given to our agency to beef up counseling, legal assistance, and outreach in connection with the mediation bill. Separate from that, we also got $220 million from the federal government, the U.S. Department of Treasury, in TARP funds to do work that we are continuing to do across Oregon that frankly helps pay mortgages on behalf of people who are unemployed. So there's lots of things going on. This particular program I know has had some advocacy in recent weeks. So I'd be happy to come back with additional facts and data if you'd like.
Thank you. Is that something you would like, Representative Wisnant?
No, ma'am. I think that the director works for the governor. The governor's budget included $4 million. I do not think that's enough. The people providing the service do not think that's enough. Remember last year, the $5 million was for 1 year, and now we're getting $4 million for 2 years. So my concern is we spent this money to set up an organization, most of that's salary, and you've got a structure now it's not going to be able to deliver the service because it's really half of what they got for last time. So I'm concerned. And
is that something we should ask the Ways and Means Committee about?
I would appreciate your support. I'll be glad to write a letter jointly with you to the Ways and Means.
And maybe we could invite them to come and speak before the whole committee. Would that work for you?
No, I think I'll talk to the chat. Thank you.
All right. Thank
Madam
you.
Madam Chair, if you're...
Representative Whitson.
Thank you. What is your budget? You talked about it passing out of Ways and Means this morning.
So Chair Tomei and Representative Whitsett, the one-year budget is just about $1 billion. Now, remember, that includes something like $600 million of, it's between $6 and $7 million, I don't have my information right here, in debt service payment for that very large bond portfolio that we've been talking about. But we get... So it's about $300 million in federal and state and other funds.
Follow up.
And how many people is that serving?
Chair Tomei and Representative Whitsett, I don't have a good answer for that for you today. Let me get back to you on that. It's a variety of different programs, 49 different programs, and the metrics are pretty diffuse, and I don't have a total.
Okay. Appreciate the number.
Yes. Okay. Thank you very much.
I'm sorry.
John, did you want to answer that? But first, if you do announce yourself, please.
John Van Laningham, Lane County Legal Aid. I think that one of the hard lessons about this agency is that very little of its funds comes from Oregon General Fund. And I was just saying to Margaret, tell them how much of that amount is Oregon General Fund.
$20 million. So, Chair Tomei and members of the committee, it's about $20 million annually that's general fund.
Thank you.
So out of all that huge budget, very little of it is state money.
Okay. Thank you, John. Thanks for clarifying that. And thank you, Margaret.
Thank you. Okay.
Thank you. Go ahead. Any other questions, I'm assuming? There are others. Okay. Thank you.
So, next.
Yeah, go for it.
Just announce yourself, please.
Is that about right? My name is Chair Tomei and members of the committee. My name is Jim Tierney. I'm the executive director of Community Action Team. We're a private nonprofit community action agency that serves the three counties in Northwest Oregon. I'm here to support Margaret and to add some value, as she mentioned on the committee, to her work. If I could digress for a moment, it might help Representative Wisnett. We are the agency that serves the $1,552. We received $95,000 from that funding source last year. We served 80 families with it, lost one house. 20 of them we were able to renew, and two or three of them we actually did manage to get appointments set this month for mediation. So there was a real value put on that from the money we received on it, an average of about $1,200 a family.
Right.
sorry, the digression.
No, that's helpful. Thank you.
What I hope to do today is to describe the work that we do as community action agencies, how we add value to our communities, and the fragility of our safety net, which I've got perhaps the world's worst graphic, but I'm not an artist, which I have handed out there. And to talk a little bit about the ways in which we plug gaps. And my experience, and probably therefore my bias in terms of community action programs, are for the rural ones, where we have scale issues that are very different than you would see in Multnomah County or some of the larger counties. One of the things that we do that adds value is the braiding of resources. Margaret talked about that as matching partnerships and so on. I think perhaps a better way to look at that is braiding of different resources. So, for example, with the money we receive from directly from HUD in the Continuum of Care program to do homeless services, we use the EHA fund that comes through Margaret's agency to help match those funds. So by braiding that money, we keep track of complying with EHA and with Continuum of Care, we're able to sort of put those two things together and add value and serve more clients and serve clients in ways that the individual programs won't allow.
I have a request of you,
sure.
Mr. Tierney. I think you use letters that some of us don't understand.
Me.
So if you would just clarify.
EHA is Emergency Housing Account.
Right.
Continuum of Care is a HUD program for homeless funds. Right. I will try to avoid that. I do, but it's second nature to us, I'm afraid.
No.
Housing Community Services, to give an example of how deep that braiding goes, Housing Community Services provides only about 25% of our funding. The rest comes from other state and federal and foundation and private sources. We have, I can beat Margaret, we have more than 90 funding sources manage that, I would say, with a three-person fiscal office. The other thing that we bring that adds value is we bring community credibility to the delivery of these programs. Our boards are from the community. We have county commissioners, we have ministers, we have low-income people, we have business people all on our boards. And in the process, when someone is frustrated with the process that Margaret's agency might add to money, we're able to say we bring expertise on both delivering in the community but also the rules, and we can say, well, here's the reason why this is happening and here's how we might work around it. So there's a degree of added value there that we do by bringing program expertise and combining it with community credibility.
Tim, could you talk a minute? You said 90 funding sources in your one community action agency?
Yes.
So give us an idea of some of those that we might not be familiar with.
Well, we have Head Start. We have OPK, the Oregon Pre-Kindergarten. We have in our homeless program, along with Emergency Housing Account, I think about a dozen different homeless programs. We have the Veterans Service Officer in our community, which I'll talk about in a minute. but veterans that are entitled to VA benefits, there's a program through the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs that encourages counties to help veterans get through the process. The process of receiving veterans benefits is very similar to seeking SSI, Social Security, I'm not sure what the I stands for, or SSD, which is Social Security Disability. It's a very complicated process, and most people, for those funding sources, actually hire attorneys. It's illegal to hire an attorney to help a vet do that in the first round. And so the state gives monies to the counties, and in our case, the county asked us to do that work. And I have an example later, and I'll go into the details of how that affects our agency, because I think it's one of the models we want to illustrate. So we look around and are asked by our board to fill gaps in the community. So each one of us is going to be different, and we'll look for a place to do that. Another example would be we have housing rehabilitation. We get community development block grant money from the state. We also seek similar money from rural development. We have our own corpus that we've developed over the years of $2 or $3 million that we turn around and lend those out to people to do home repair. We have weatherization through Margaret's program. The lovely thing about the programs that come through Margaret's agency is we might have four different funding sources for the same activity. So that makes it nice and confusing. So some of that 90 is a multiplier effect. It's a wide variety of different services that we have added because they're what needed in the community, and we figured out a way to provide the service. So the next thing I wanted to do is talk about the safety net. And as I said, I had a little graphic that I handed out, and part of my fear in all of this is that it's really easy to miss what goes on the ground that's of real value. And I don't want to embarrass anyone here, but Margaret talked about not coordinating with DHS in her talk. The fact is, she doesn't know, but her agency through ours does indeed coordinate with DHS. It might never get to LESL, but at the local level, if you look at the chart, it just so happens we had DHS SNAP and DHS TANF. My homeless staff and our energy assistance staff actually work with the local agency. They go out to lunch once or twice a month to talk about how they're working together and deliver services. So there's at the local level, there's a lot of social capital that happens, and that's the reason I did this chart. I'm afraid that it'll be easy to miss the social capital if we don't recognize that on the ground, heaven knows I wouldn't want to have to do this myself. I have a lot of really fantastic staff, 200 as a matter of fact, and they do a terrific job of penetrating the community and finding partners and getting out there and delivering services in ways that I couldn't articulate because they know them better than I do. And this THS thing is a perfect example.
Where are your staff located?
We have Clatsop, Tillamook, and Columbia counties. We have a bigger presence in Columbia County because we actually are the one community action agency in the state that tries to push the community action services out into the other two remote counties for multiple county. Rocky Johnson, who was our original director when this came about, believed that it wasn't possible for community action with its base in Columbia County to ever be local in Tillamook or Clatsop. It's something I've seen proved over and over and over again. So first thing we did was form advisory committees in those two counties and then gradually worked them out of bed to being their own nonprofits, and the staff there were kind of kicking and screaming. But in fact, it was really a huge benefit. Give me one example. Every one of those nonprofits has their own set of volunteers, their own fundraising effort, and things that we could never do locally there. And if we did try, we would be a shadow of what they can do. A perfect example is in Clatsop Community Action is our agency that we work with in Astoria. They have the food bank there. They raise $70,000 to $100,000 a year to support the food bank. If we went to do that in Clatsop County to support the food bank, we'd get $7,000 if we were lucky. So pushing it out into the local community, even within Columbia County, Women's Resource Center was part of CAT. We were the first one that founded that. We spun that off. Now they have their own suite of volunteers, their own fundraising. The food bank in Columbia County is the same way. We spun that off. And that what that does is it brings extra people out of the weeds to help support that activity in a way that it mm-hmm. doesn't build a big, strong organization at CAT, but it builds a big, strong county.
So what do we have like in Klamath County, where Representative Whitsitt is from?
You have Klamath, the Community Action, and I think it's Klamath Community Action, I think.
Community Action.
Yeah, the two counties there. Again, one of the things that I was hoping to talk about, I'll leave this aside with one last thing. The dark squares are where we have a contact that's based on a board connection. And the squares with just the light X's are where we have formal or semi-formal relationships with others. Representative Tremaine, members of the committee. One of the interesting things about community action programs in the state is that they're an artifact of the history of their particular communities. So there's no point in having us go and start a housing program, which we did at CAT, if there was another party there doing it. Or if there's a women's resource center already, there's no point in moving into that area, but rather to support it. And so what that causes is there are a suite of programs. We get core programs from Housing Community Services. But many of us have moved out into other areas. And in some places, those areas are already used up by others, or the areas are so small that the amount of capacity it takes to do that is a real damper. Klamath Lake Community Action is a fairly small organization, but if you think about the counties and the geography, it's a very tough place to work. Tillamook is another place in our area, is a very tough place to work, in part because its median income is so low, and it makes it hard to bring other resources in to help. I hope that answers the question.
Yes, thank you.
So finally, I wanted to talk about how we build programs, and I was going to use the Veterans Service Officer as an example. The Columbia County asked us to take over the VSO work in part because they were losing money at it. They have more overhead, and it's more expensive for them to operate than it is for us. And so we took that over, and it's been kind of a red ink program for a number of years, $4,000, $5,000, $6,000 a year. We have to find some fundraising to fill that gap. But it's an important need. If you think about what happens there, it brings literally millions of dollars over time into the local economy. So and 80% of the families people we serve are low income. So it's a really definitely in our mission. Looking at that, one of the ways we address that is, well, we have this expertise in veterans now. What can we make of that? So a year and a half ago, we started a program with the VA to form the Supportive Services for Veterans and Families, SSVF grant, and we received a $600,000 grant. In order to do that, we needed to form a partnership in Washington County, Tillamook, and Clatsop in Columbia, and that $600,000 every year, and we've got another one we hope will get funded any day now, but that provides services and housing for homeless vets. By putting those two things together, we find a way to both staunch the red ink and provide more services. So that marrying of opportunity or fixing of problems is one of the ways we go about building up that 90 programs that we talked about. That's how we fill gaps. We look for where there's a need, use our expertise that we have on staff, and then find a way to fund the program. So I've probably gone way over my time. So
you're doing fine, but as I hear, maybe other people are are seeing something that I'm not. But I, as I hear you talking about bringing these other funds from what 90 funding sources, and I know Margaret gave us the spaghetti. I mean, it's always going to be spaghetti, isn't it?
Yes. Sorry.
Okay.
It's always going to be that way.
Okay. Thank you very much, Jim. John.
Madam Chair, committee members, my name is John Van Landingham. I work as a lawyer with Lane County Legal Aid in Eugene. I'm going to tell you a little bit about my background so you'll have some sense of why Margaret chose me or why I agreed to do this. I'm a legal aid lawyer. So legal aid is a nonprofit that provides free legal service to low-income people on civil matters, not criminal matters, but civil matters. I've done it for 35 years, right out of law school. My specialty is landlord-tenant law. You've seen me before, you talking about the two landlord-tenant coalitions. I actually wrote a comment in a law review article in 1977 on the Oregon adoption in 1973 of the Uniform Residential Landlord and Tenant Act. I've noted for lots of people that when you go to law school, your friends all think that you're a great source of free legal advice, and they're all tenants like you are, and so they always ask you, can my landlord do that? And I tried to figure that out. So after about 5 years of fighting off evictions, forcing landlords to make repairs, dealing with the housing authority over subsidized housing issues, my boss and I realized that we were really dealing with the symptoms and not the root cause, which was a lack of affordable housing. And so for the last 30 years, really, I, besides doing landlord-tenant law, I've really focused a lot on affordable housing development, starting first at the local level. With Lane County and Eugene and Springfield, I've served on dozens of local government committees talking about those sorts of things, worked on dozens of different issues to provide affordable housing, from advocacy to actually doing the legal work to help build a housing cooperative, a low-income housing cooperative, or helping residents with a condominium conversion, or getting a rental housing enforcement code adopted and designed. So all those different things are issues that I think are relevant to housing in the state of Oregon. That led at one point to being encouraged by the City of Eugene planning staff to join, to apply for, and I did. I got, although it took me two tries, to the Eugene Planning Commission, where I served for 12 years, and the City of Eugene's done a ton of things in terms of simplifying its development code and zoning code to encourage and promote affordable housing. I've got a four-page memo of things that other local governments can do, which I have tried to proselytize at various meetings of the League of Oregon Cities or Association of Oregon Counties, and they often say, great ideas, but we don't have the staff to do those. But anyway, I then got recruited to apply to be on the Land Conservation and Development Commission. I was term limited off the Eugene Planning Commissioner. I never would have done LCDC, but I did. And I served 12 years on LCDC, the last seven as chair, and that service ended in November of 2011. So that's pretty recent, and I frankly still miss it, although I must say that when I started, I thought I was crazy. It was not fun. And we never got to the reason I do all this, which is Goal 10 housing on LCDC. We're just lamenting that last week during the 40th anniversary of the land use program. I think I'm good at analyzing issues and problems and working with people with differing views to find a solution that works. And I think I was successful as an LCDC chair for that, because of that. And I think that's why I'm successful with the two landlord-tenant coalitions. If you can work land use issues, or if you can work with manufactured home park landlords and find something that works, that's significant to me. And so that's the quality I want to bring to Margaret's work group. I've worked as, and I understand roles as an advocate, as a staff person. I've staffed groups. I often found that it was easier for me to write the stuff than to have somebody else write it, and that way I got to control the product. And I'm used to being a decision maker, a policy maker. I think the people in the affordable housing community, and that's what I think I represent, I understand how affordable housing is developed. The money, the politics, the neighbors, the tools. The affordable housing community in Oregon is very nervous about this effort. Change is difficult, no matter what organization you're talking about. In my 12 years of service on LCDC, I think at least for the last 10, we had a commission and a staff that wanted to change the land use program to make it more simple, more flexible, more responsive. And part of that is because you get constantly beat up by people who are unhappy with it and complain about the process. One of the stories I told last week in a panel in Portland was that we had the city of Woodburn appearing before us to propose to expand its urban growth boundary. 1,000 friends opposed. We had a process. That process was each side got 20 minutes. The mayor of Woodburn used 19 of her 20 minutes to complain about the process. That left 1 minute for her highly paid and very skilled consultant to respond on the substance. They were not happy. And so what I did after that was create a different process for that kind of discussion. But anyway, I've got that experience of working with people with different views. And I think that in this case, you've got, I guess what I was starting to say was that people complain about the land use program, but then when you sit down and say, let's talk about changing it, they all go, whoa, wait a minute. I like that part of it. I don't want you to change that part of it. You can change that part of it. Or, I don't know, this is too complicated. Change is hard. I think people are nervous about this. I don't doubt that what Margaret is proposing here, or the governor is proposing here, is necessary. I think that from an affordable housing development standpoint, the system needs to be more efficient, more effective, more flexible. But I do have doubts about whether we can do it well, and also, mainly, whether we can do it in a year. My wife this weekend finished reading Killer Angels, which Representative Wisnett had recommended to me. I grew up in Virginia. And she asked me, so what did Virginians think of General Longstreet? And the question is because General Longstreet led or supervised the famous Pickett's charge at the Battle of Gettysburg, which was very unsuccessful, to put it mildly. And a lot of people blame him for that loss, at least from the South. I think the accurate view is that General Longstreet did what General Lee told him to do. He argued with General Lee. He disagreed with General Lee. That was his role. But then he implemented the orders, and that's kind of how I'm thinking of my role here. My role is to tell Margaret what I think as honestly as I can and effectively as I can, but she's going to make the decision, and we're going to try to implement it. Thank you.
Thank you, John. Any quick questions of Mr. Van Landingham? Thank you.
Thanks. Good afternoon, Chair Tomei, members of the committee. My name is Lisa Wendt, and I'm the Director of Self-Sufficiency Programs at DHS. And like John, I thought it might be useful to give a little bit of my background, since I've spent a fair amount of time both on housing issues, but most importantly on issues facing people who are living in poverty. Most recently, I was the director at 211 Info. And to be honest, a lot of my motivation to go work for state government came from that experience. My office intentionally opened up onto the call center, so all day, every day, I could hear at least one side of the conversation. And for many people who are maybe not in poverty yet, but who are in need, face these 90 funding streams or 49 funding streams in real time. And so a lot of my motivation is, how do we make sure we're thinking of the people and the families first? Because, yes, change is hard, but we're leaving it up to families to navigate that right now. So what is it that we can do at a systems level to help facilitate local contact, system change that may make that easier for people who every day are having to knock on multiple doors to get their needs met? I remember we've had several, some of you here on tours at 211, but in particular a city commissioner who came and listened to a phone call, and it was somebody who was about to get evicted, had some other past due utility bills that they hadn't been able to pay, had children that they were worried about feeding, weren't yet on the SNAP program, and listening to how many referrals that person was given to get those different needs met just overwhelmed this particular commissioner to say, we really make people work that hard on different ends of town and with different programs to navigate to get their basic needs met. And we do. We really do. It is spaghetti. And so I think the glass half full approach to this transition team planning is how do we really put families first and individuals first in these conversations and do that hard work? And it will be extremely hard work and some probably not very popular decisions along the way to help make it easier for families to get their needs met. So that's a little bit of my background. I also worked for Mayor Potter in the city of Portland and worked on the Housing Bureau's budget there. And there are tough decisions to be made about which piece of this puzzle are we going to fund and prioritize, because you don't, to your point, have all the dollars available. So I appreciate the decisions that are going to be coming ahead, and I appreciate Margaret's openness to recognizing the that this will be challenging. And I think just naming that, and you've heard that from the other participants, is a really important piece of the puzzle. To fast forward to DHS, and Jim hit on this really well, at the local level, I think in some cases, there are natural partnerships that happen. There are caseworkers who have figured out, you know, I know that person and we're working with the same family, and how do we knit together resources on their behalf? So I think there is some really good work that happens. I also think there's work we can do to expedite some of those relationships at a local level. We've already heard from some of our district staff, I really do need to reach out to the community action director in my community and start to make those plans about what does this look like locally. So some of that work, frankly, can continue to happen while the transition planning is going on. There's a way that we can start to build relationships and expedite some of this work. I think the other piece is we also know that many TANF families, about 85% of TANF families, aren't actually receiving public housing, whether that be Section 8 or rent subsidies. So if we can begin to close that gap for TANF families, we'll really get to our outcomes for TANF families, which are family stability and employment. But without housing, I think we can all agree those two outcomes are going to be awfully difficult to achieve. So you think about that $506 average cash grant, that's not going to go very far in terms of taking care of a family and taking care of housing needs. So I think the conversation that we're really having with our field office is, what does it look like to do wraparound services, and how can we leverage what's the existing housing services that are available and not recreate that infrastructure within DHS? So we have partners at HCS and at the community action agencies who do this work well, who've been doing it a long time. Our challenge now is how do we reach out and help build those connections for the actual families. In addition, if we look at child welfare and aging and people with disabilities, there's really been an identified lack of affordable housing for drug-free housing, case management, so that's happening on-site, that's supported with alcohol and drug housing. So I think really looking at what are those specific needs that families have. It's not just housing, but it's that other service component that goes with it. Counseling and coaching to keep housing and avoid eviction, which is a lot of the work that I think John does. The need for emergency housing fund for crisis. Again, going back to my 2-in-1 experience, people who might just need $100 to pay their rent, it's so difficult to find after the fifth of the month, and different communities that looks really different. I think your point about some communities having more resources than others is really true. You know, if you don't have a strong faith community, you're going to be evicted because you just couldn't make that last piece of it, and then the cost to put somebody in housing with first and last month's rent is really challenging and much more expensive. So really looking at that short-term crisis housing. And then for seniors, making sure that they have affordable housing so they're not choosing more costly places to live, whether that be 24-hour care or having to make drastic changes because they can't afford basic affordable housing in their own community. So for DHS, we currently have a housing stabilization program partnership with HCS, where we give them $1 million for the biennium that then is matched. Housing and Community Services, apologies. And those dollars really help TANF-eligible families stay in their housing. So it's not a lot of money, but that's one area where we currently are partnering and leveraging the community action system. So those two case managers will work together to make sure that vulnerable families have housing, at least as far as $1 million over a biennium will go, which I think Margaret and Community Action folks will tell you, it goes quickly. But that's an important partnership and one that I think is a good place to look at in terms of this transition planning about what has worked about that. So we, DHS, looking ahead to the transition planning, I'll be representing DHS on that committee, we'll be really bringing what are the pieces that DHS provides, what are the different groups of people that we work with, what are those housing needs, and how do we help facilitate some of those local connections while the transition planning is happening, but also looking ahead to implementation. So I think as Margaret said, there's no decisions made, and we're really eager to figure out how do we wrap around services for the different populations that we serve and eliminate kind of that spaghetti or chaos. We can define it lots of different ways on behalf of the people that we're all hoping to achieve independence with.
Thank you, Liesl. Any questions? Representative Wisner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Jim, thank you for your testimony, and I'll have to get those examples from you when I start writing my letters, but it sounds like you've been successful. But, Madam Chair, I think what we're looking here is the director's looking for advice. She's hired these, or identified these people to help her make a choice. But if you look at Jim's, if you look at the operation that I have in my district, Neighbor Impact, they have all this spaghetti coming to them, too, and it works. So, sorry, but... Margaret, it may not be best to do away with the agency.
She has a boss, too. Any other questions? This committee, I think, has a great interest in private-public partnerships, and we like hearing that. That also, of course, creates a spaghetti, and we're glad that people are reaching out to find these other little pots of money that helps individuals and families. We're eager to hear how all of this is going to be laid out. We'd like to have you back in September to sort of give us an update. This sounds very ambitious and very, very difficult. You've taken on a great big elephant that you're going to try to take a bite out of. So I appreciate you being willing to serve on this, and you too, Margaret, and your staff. But it's a very difficult issue. Any last questions? Thank you so much. We see a lot of other people here. We do have some time. If anybody else has anything they would like to add to this discussion, any questions that you have, anything you'd like the committee to address in the future or this agency. Nobody is jumping up, colleagues.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Representative Gillen.
I just wanted to be sure that I'm certain you didn't mean anything derogatory about your comment about an elephant.
You like it? Oh.
Taking a bite out of you.
Make sure that
none whatsoever, Representative. Thank you for the question.
I knew that.
From who is... Oh, this is from Jean. So did you get these questions asked? Did you want me to ask more questions? Okay, but you didn't want me to ask any more questions now. Okay.
Did you sit
down? He's heading out.
Make me go to the restroom.
Okay. More information than we needed. Thank you. With that, I think we will close the informational hearing on Oregon Housing and Community Services and close the House Committee on Human Services and Housing.
Thank you.
So thank